I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about how to understand what's going on in the stock markets. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. World stock markets have taken us on a wild ride, as many of you know. In case it makes you feel better, I just came upon a New Yorker cartoon by Bob Mankoff from 13 years ago. The cartoon shows a TV network news host reporting bad news on Wall Street today as the bottom fell out of the market, the sides collapsed, and the top blew away. Instead of the cartoon host, our regular financial analysts are here, Bob and Charlie Kreitler, to give us their perspective on what's happening and how to protect ourselves in a roller coaster atmosphere like this one. Bob and Charlie run the wealth management firm Kreitler Financial in New Haven, affiliated with Raymond James, though their opinions on this show are their own. Welcome back. Let's get right to it. So I looked at Bloomberg News just before the show, and there is a headline from a couple of hours ago saying something else going on in China that has to do with the futures index and a drop there. And then I turn to my phone right this minute, and I see that we are about 53 minutes away from the close of the market in the U.S., and the Dow is up 300 and almost 53 points. Still 53 minutes to go. Things could change, but 353 points. Bob Kreitler, what's going on out there?
Well, there's an awful lot going on, and I think there's more uncertainty than usual, which makes it more and more challenging. But there's an awful lot of today it's good, tomorrow it's bad, and things like this. And the real challenge, which we'll talk about throughout the rest of the show, is how do we have a more steady investment strategy so that we don't get caught in the ups and downs.
But you'll both say this, the world is wild at the moment.
The world is wild, but we still have to have an investment strategy that deals with it.
I would say that specifically because it's wild, that's why we need an investment strategy. It allows us to take a step back and react not just to what the latest news is, because it's coming at us today faster and faster than it ever has before, but to really sit back and understand what is the big picture, what is the world trying to tell us, and how does it affect me and my life?
So mostly we are seeing in the headlines news about China, Russia, Europe, the Middle East, as you know, where there's talk about migrants and oil exploration in the Arctic, the U.S. elections coming. All of this is exerting pressure on the world markets.
Which is normal, and where you also have the changing role of the United States throughout the world. This is a major event that's happening. We also have the monetary authorities doing things they've never done before. And then there we have the question of whether the Federal Reserve is going to increase interest rates in the near future or not. And we've been in an extended period of time that they're providing liquidity to the markets, to the world, we've never seen before. And we don't know how we're going to be backing out of this or how the markets are going to react.
We have reports that in economists in China, financial managers within the government might not know exactly what they're doing, that some of the propping up that they've engaged in is not being handled in the way that economists worldwide would like to see it happening. So if you look ahead, what do you think is going to happen in at least the near future?
Well, I think we're going to have a huge amount of uncertainty still. We're now in September. We're going to be moving into October. In the United States, these historically have been the most challenging months for the stock market.
September, October.
Are we going to continue that? We certainly look like we have started that. But those are also short-term events. But we have a lot of long-term stuff we have to weigh or get through. Now, we've been through since 2008, 2009 without a, quote, major correction in the market. And what we have seen is, even though investors were scared to death and all kinds of stuff, and we had all kinds of headlines, it was a relatively small move in the stock markets in terms of the United States and Europe.
So that's the comment I think that gets an underline so far. We saw a drop of, well, what was the major drop recently? I don't want to do a number in case I'm inaccurate. About 1,000?
Boy, I think the big one was that intraday drop on a Monday a week or two ago, where it was about 1,000 points. And then recovered throughout the rest of the day. But that certainly raised some eyebrows.
It did. And the question here, I'm coming back to your underline Bob Kreitler. Was that a correction? When something gets to 350, 4, that number, 400, a drop of that kind, people's heads snap around a little bit, even though they're invested for the long term. That's a sizable number. And yet you just said that these are pretty normal, these kinds of corrections.
These are normal, and we have been saying for some period of time that we were due for a correction, and we just haven't had anything. And so we finally do have something, and my question is this just a small correction that we're dealing with, or is this something bigger? And we don't know the answer to that, but you never know the answer to that. And what's important is to have an investment strategy that, as we go into these things, you can say, oh, I have an investment strategy and I'm going to be able to stick with it and I can run through, I can get through this kind of stuff without bailing out at the bottom and then having the market recover and things such as that.
Right. I was reading an essay by the savvy economist and author Bob Shiller, and he was saying, well, according to various indexes that he's assembled, he had some nervousness about long-term prospects. And so I think there's agreement here that this is going to be a bit of a roller coaster. But again, we don't know. We do know this, that at this moment, the Dow high was 18,000 something. And we are now in the 16,000s. So we've lost roughly, since the high, I guess in the spring, we've lost roughly 2,000 points. Correct, on the U.S. market.
That's right. And I think it's important to put that in perspective because 2,000 sounds like a really big number. But, of course, what we're talking about is about 10%. And historically speaking, that's what we would normally just start calling a correction. And they happened with fairly regular intervals over time. So it's not unusual for us to have experienced this. Now the challenge, I think, for us is an emotional one, and that is that these things, once they get started, they tend to last longer than we'd like them to. And we're seeing yet another volatile day in the market today, thankfully an up day, but that's still volatility and that's still unsettling, and it may signal that this thing isn't quite through yet.
So here's what we want to know, just to take care of our psychology going forward, because we're going to get into how to think about what a long-term strategy is, what to do in the face of a drop on any given day. Do you hold? Do you sell? What is the long-term investor to do? And how important, what do we mean by diversification? Across what? And how important is it to keep saving? And I mean money that's not, quote-unquote, working for you. You know, if you're just simply saving money, how important is that? We're going to try to get to all of that in this hour. So the big question in terms of our psychology is, what is a real signal that something very serious is going on? I mean, we know what happened in, what was it, 2000 and was it 4?
Well,
I mean, 2008
with the ending in 2009.
Yeah, so we know what that feels like and sounds like. But how do we tell what is a real signal that there is big trouble ahead like that versus what's just noise? What would you call right now the tip of a signal? Pay close attention, or would you say it's noise?
I think what you're getting at is probably the biggest challenge that all of us face in making decisions about finance and other things as well. And one of the challenges that we face is the news cycle has only increased. We're now able to get up-to-the-minute information on the internet, and who knows whether it's true. I mean, I remember seeing recently a cartoon which was a quote that you have to verify the sources of what you see on the internet, and it was signed Abraham Lincoln.
But it's not only a question. It's not only a question knowing whether it's true, but it's also a question of knowing whether it's relevant, because there's so much stuff happening out there.
So, are you dancing around my question by any
yes.
chance? Okay, good. I just want to make sure. So, you don't want to commit to whether this is noise or the start of a serious signal. Are you saying because who can predict?
Clearly, you can't predict. You need to have a strategy that's going to be able to deal with all of this. And for some time, we have said there's more risk than usual out there, and therefore the strategy has to be an asset allocation that is more diverse than usual so you can live through these things. And there's not going to be a single signal that says, hey, okay, we've reached a point and we need to sell. Uh-huh. We are not going to recommend that. I don't think we're going to know when that's going to happen.
So let me try and get at this from a different sneaky angle. Are you saying that you think investors should pretty much expect lower returns?
That's a totally different question. And I think
sneaky.
It was sneaky. But the answer to that is probably lower returns for the immediate future because the monetary authorities have driven interest rates to very low levels. And that's going to be reflected in portfolios. So one should expect to have a lower rate of return. And this has huge consequences because it affects the question of, well, how much do I need to retire? There have been the Wall Street Journal on a series of articles about how states are recognizing the assumed rate of return they're going to have on pensions needs to be dropped, and they're dropping them from 8% to 7.5%, and I think they're way too high.
Even at 7.5%.
At 7.5%, because you're going to have a bond portfolio that maybe gets you 2 or 3%, and you mix that with a stock portfolio, if you're lucky to get 8%, you're not going to average at 7.5%. What you're saying is really important, and it affects pension funds, it affects individuals, and people need to probably be saving even more than they did before. And you sort of say, well, if I'm not going to get a good rate of return, why save at all? And the answer is you got to save more because the returns are going to be smaller, and if you need a certain amount in retirement, that becomes a really big challenge for you.
We're with longtime contributors and financial analysts Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven. Have been on the show for a long time talking with us. So what about this idea that the Fed, everybody's trying to second guess when they're going to do this. At some point, of course, they're going to have to raise interest rates. Agreed? We're agreed.
I think yes. Yes. And I will come back to this, but yes, they are going to increase interest rates at some point in time.
And what does the market do traditionally? How does the market react to that?
You know, there's this conventional wisdom out there that says that when interest rates go up, stock prices go down. And I think, you know, this is a case where the conventional wisdom may not be entirely right. And if you actually go back and you look at some of the long-standing trends, when interest rates start to go up from very low levels in the past, the markets have been able to continue to go up. And there seems to be a tipping point at which point once the interest rates start to go above that, well, then they're going to start to run into some challenges because people start to question, well, if I can get, you know, higher rate of return taking very little risk, why do I want to put my money at risk in stocks? But I think, you know, our belief is that having interest rates go up might not be a bad thing. But it's a real question as to how that unfolds.
And why wouldn't it be a bad thing? You're saying it might not be a bad thing for interest rates to go up.
I think that there's a couple of things that happen. One is it would sure be nice to be able to reward people for saving in as simple as a bank account. And right now the interest rates, I'm sure all of our listeners out here have seen, are just so, so low that it's difficult to get any sort of return on your money. But the second is that it's going to start giving the Federal Reserve and other monetary authorities a little more ammunition should we come into another problem. Now, they're not without other tools, but certainly interest rates have been an important one in the past. And I think that the last point is that when you have money that is extraordinarily cheap and people can borrow it, sometimes they borrow it and spend it on things that aren't very smart. And if you borrow money at cheap rates and you spend it on a productive asset or something that you're going to get a long-term return on, whether it's a financial return or the use of it, well, that's one thing. But if you go out and spend it on things that are just going to depreciate or won't have value over time, like a nice car or something, well, then that's a different story.
It does raise this issue, doesn't it? I wish we had time to go into it, maybe another show, of whether houses, you know, this has to do with people buying houses, whether houses are a losing business in the end, unless you are very, very lucky about the neighborhood you happen to live in. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about what's going on in specific sectors, the sectors that most people are invested in. How do we diversify in a market like this? What should we do? What's considered a great amount to save? Or how low can we go and have it mean something? Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. It is great to have you listening. We are with our longtime contributors and financial analysts, Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven, and we're talking about what's going on out there in the market. You probably know that because it is noisy, it's just noisy out there, and we're all trying to figure out how much to pay attention to that. Is this the normal noise? The world is always a roller coaster. Life is unpredictable. Or is this the start of something big, as they like to say? So, so far we're hearing at least it's noisy, though the two guests here believe that returns will be lower. Lots of state governments are being told to lower their projections for their own investments. And Bob Kreitler is saying he still thinks they're too high. So that shows you that we're in for a bit of a rough patch, it sounds like. Still, there is some good news. There's one thing I want to start with, and that is the role that governments seem to be playing in economies, you know, action, real action, taking part in directing how things are going to go in financial markets. Can you speak to that?
Well, one of the things, and this is sort of a totally unknown in terms of the risk involved in it, but since 2008, the U.S. monetary authorities, the Fed, and then the European monetary authorities, and then following by China, are taking a larger and larger role in keeping the economies going. And the role is unprecedented, and they have smoothed things out. And I am quite concerned that at some point things are going to break down because they've sort of the government is not the best way to solve all the problems. So now, we do have an example right now, and that's China, because China has smoothed things out, and all of a sudden they realized they couldn't do it anymore, and that has caused some of the current volatility around the world.
By smoothing things out, you mean propping up?
We don't want a thing have bad. Wouldn't it be terrible to have the GDP drop below a certain thing? We need to have growth. The government should come in and sustain that. And this is all new, that what we should rely on the government to keep the economies going.
Well, as we know, the United States government has been very involved in the economy in a very serious way. And are you nervous about that?
Well, I'm very nervous about it. And that's what our citizens want. They drive this. Well, we can't possibly have some bad times. We want the Federal Reserve to solve it. So this is one of the risks. I have no idea what timing on this is going to be, whether it's 6 months, 6 years, or 10 years out, or 20 years out.
Well, what are we smoothing over?
Well, by having the government run so many things, they're causing huge distortion in the financial markets and the real markets. And so we're keeping businesses running that perhaps shouldn't. But when you shift decision-making to the government, you're taking it away from the marketplace and the free markets, and it's virtually guaranteed to be less efficient and probably will someday run into problems.
When we look back at the I think, pretty extreme measures that were taken in 2008, 2009, 2010, I mean, we think back and think there was the significant stimulus spending of 2009 and the following years. Some of which I think we're benefiting from here in New Haven with all the highway construction. But the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which was the purchasing of some of these assets, the massive money issuance in the form of quantitative easing, Part 1, Part 2, and then Part 3 from the Federal Reserve. And all of these were an effort to take what was a very big crisis and try to spread the impact of it out, say, we're not going to have to face all of this right now with a huge downturn, but instead we're going to push all this money out there. We're going to generate all this additional debt to do that. What does that do? I mean, it's like putting a big mortgage on your house and saying, well, I'm going to pay for this over many years rather than just a few.
So is this 2020 hindsight? I'm asking you, we had never faced something like what we faced in 2008, except for the Great Depression, and it looked like we might have another one. So is this you looking in the rearview mirror saying, oh, we could have done a better job with that, or I wish we hadn't done that at all, or look where we are now? I mean, wasn't it absolutely necessary?
I don't believe that that's a comment on it being better or worse. It's just a question of, do you want to deal with short, harder pain, or longer, lesser pain? And I think as a society, we chose to say, well, we want to have this sort of spread out a little bit. And that's certainly been reflected in some of the slower growth numbers that we've seen. And the challenge that we're going to have going forward is now we still have the legacy of some of these policies. We still have the extremely low interest rates. We still have the question of how is the Federal Reserve going to unwind the quantitative easing without causing ripples through the rest of the economy.
So soft and slow landing.
Yeah.
Is what we're talking about.
And we still have, I think, the average citizen saying we want the government to solve this for us. And so as long as the average citizen says that, that's going to be happening.
Yeah. Now going over to China again, they're taking these measures in a more extreme. And I think we should be very grateful that we're not seeing journalists disciplined for saying negative things in the newspaper. We're seeing China taking some very extreme
measures.
Well,
there'd be nobody left.
What? The airwaves would get very quiet.
Okay. So what is there any good news?
Yeah, there's lots of good news.
Well, I think, we continue to look at what's going on in the world. Yes, we think we're in a period where the markets are going to be choppy, and there's certainly a chance that things could get worse before they get better. But our expectation long run is that, yeah, things will get better. The GDP numbers that were recently updated for the first quarter of the year have continued to look better and better. I also continue to remind myself that when we look at the risk in the markets, risk is highest when the prices are highest. And now that we've seen this correction of, 10% or so, we're able to find better bargains out there. We're getting more stock for our money.
Well, that is a big question. I want to tell you that all these years that you've been coming on the show, and we've talked about the economy and what is the meaning of wise investing and what's diversification really and the most major way you can get it. Still, when there was that drop of 1,000 points, the first thought that went sailing through my head, I wish I had cash. Wouldn't this be the greatest moment when you look at Apple's on sale, Google's on sale, everything's on sale at the moment. I wanted to have cash. Is that a bad way to think? If you had cash, would you have jumped in?
Well, first of all, we did have cash, and no, I did not jump in.
So why?
And I guess one of Bob's personal philosophy is that when prices are moving that fast, I am very reluctant to make sales or purchases. I want to see some stability because I've gotten caught in markets that are uncontrollable, shall we say. So I want to see some stability. And I would love to see a little more stability in the next couple of weeks.
What does that mean to you, stability? What would be a signal of stability to you?
The market's not moving 300, 400 points a day or 1,000 points a day.
Uh-huh. You can feel just a little bit of pain or a lot of pain from this description. You know how there's just never a good answer? Because if you're waiting, then the bargain has gone away. But you're saying it's smarter to wait.
But that's sort of a short-term issue. I mean, long-term, we want a strategy that's going to be able to deal with these ups and downs. And so that these things are just small decisions instead of big decisions. We don't want people selling their portfolios at this point in time.
Let's talk. There's advice right there. We don't want people selling portfolios at this time. So I bet that's not how everybody behaved. I bet there are some people who said, I'm out of here again if we're going anywhere near a danger zone. Let's talk about that. I want to open the phones if you have questions for my guests, Bob and Charlie Kreitler. 203-776-9677. Easy way to remember, 203-776-WNPR. Brett, welcome to the show. Are you there, Brett? Oh, did we lose him? Yeah, okay, sorry. You could try and call again because we did have Brett on the line. You don't want people selling their portfolios right now. Am I quoting you correctly?
We want people to have strategies that they can deal with these things and they don't have to make the decision of whether I'm going to buy 100% today or sell 100%. That's not the way you do long-term investing.
There's a reality that picking up the newspaper tomorrow, if we didn't have the internet, we didn't know that the S&P or the Dow was up 300 points, if we picked up the newspaper and we said, well, what did it do? It's almost random as to what tomorrow's return is going to be, what yesterday's return was. And trying to base investment decisions on that very short time horizon, is just almost impossible. I mean, I suppose there are some people who claim they can do it very well with computer algorithms and so on. But for the average person, we don't have that capability. So what we're instead left with is focusing on the thing that we have control over the most, and that is time.
So this idea of diversification, as you would apply it, knowing what you know right now, what does it look like? How much in U.S. stocks? How much in foreign stocks? What about bonds? What does the diversification, the ideal diversification, look like to the two of you?
I think, first of all, there is no, quote, ideal. And the question of diversification between stocks, bonds, and other assets is probably the number one. One of the things Charlie and I were noting as the market was dropping is how most stocks around the world were moving together. So this ability to invest outside the United States versus inside the United States had a much smaller impact on the returns.
Interesting.
But the question of fixed income, real estate, unconstrained bond funds, all these things are ways to begin to diversify away so we're not totally dependent upon the stock markets.
And I think, I mean, the first question, this it's so personal and individual. The first question everyone needs to understand is, so if things don't go well, because we know on average the markets have lost money one out of every 4 years, it's going to happen again, what can I afford to lose? And also, what am I going to be able to lose without getting nauseous, without having, agita or just becoming so emotionally overwrought that it starts to physically do harm to me, or I start to make poor decisions? And this is that person who, you know, they just can't stand seeing that 1,000-point drop in the Dow, even though, I mean, we're talking, I think it was under 5%. But it's still such an emotional response. We want to make sure that we have a portfolio that has the appropriate amount of risk in it, that we don't push those boundaries. And that gets to Dad's big question of, so how much do I want to have in stocks versus less risky assets like bonds, like cash, and so on?
Okay, what about that? What are we talking about percentages? What advice do you give us about how to diversify specifically?
Well, some of our young people that are dealing with 30 and 40 and 50-year time horizons and a movement of 5, 10, 20, and even 30 and 40% when you look over the long term is not that urgent or critical. So they can have very high number in stocks. And if they're willing to live with a 40% drop, sure, they can be in 89% stocks. Now, someone who's coming up on retirement and we can't afford to lose 10 or 20% of their portfolio, then you've got to be down 30, 40, or 50% stocks. So how much can you afford to lose? And over the long term, stocks have outperformed other things. So that's maybe where you want to be. But you have to be able to deal with the volatility. And on the risk side, there's the risk, how much can I afford to lose? And then there's a question, well, how much can I live with? And some people can live with a 30 or 40% drop in their portfolio in terms of psychologically, but in terms of retirement, they couldn't retire. So there are various kinds of risks and volatility we need to worry about.
Don't you think that among people who are diving out of this market would be those who are just on the edge of retirement or just retiring right now? And I feel for them, because if they're just about to switch over to something a little bit more conservative as they go into retirement to protect and grow their money at the same time, then that 10% drop that we just had is significant for them.
And hopefully all of those people have some kind of a plan. And historically, you know, if you have that kind of plan, you don't suddenly switch from your 90% stock growth portfolio to your conservative retiree portfolio. I mean, typically when we work with individuals and families, there's a process that takes, some time as we approach a retirement date. And that I would suggest everyone should be thinking along those lines.
You mean a slow approach? We're talking about a soft landing, but a slow approach to retirement.
Maybe a nice glide path would be a good analogy.
Okay. Here's our number, 203-776-0590. WNPR if you have questions for Bob and Charlie Kreitler about the economy. So we're going to expect increased volatility and probably some lower returns, according to you. There's probably going to be more risk ahead than we've seen for a while. It's been a pretty glorious time out there for quite a while. So you were just saying have a long-term plan and keep it steady. The idea, I guess, is not to jump around based on headlines.
Yes, absolutely. And to do that is very dangerous. Remember, we're looking out for 10 years, 20 years or something like this. And what happens today or tomorrow is very, has no importance. It's almost irrelevant in terms of 10 or 20 years from now.
So here has been a piece of advice from the two of you, and I would love to have you explain this. Diversification, what we're talking about, of course, is spreading investments into a lot of different categories so that as one goes up and another one goes down, you're not hit too hard. That's the that's wise investing. So you say this diversification, you should also use it in asset classes, not just stocks. What does that mean?
If we look at stocks as individual companies, their performance can be very different. But when we look at the stock market as a whole, there's this overlay. There's a lot of people who are trading the whole market. They're using index funds and what have you. So the fact that I own a good company or a bad company can be overwhelmed in a busy day of trading, such as what we saw with that 1,000-point drop. Didn't matter whether you owned the best company in the index or the worst company in the index. They all were moving very quickly. So one of the things that we like to do is we like to put things into a portfolio that are going to give us a positive return over time, but maybe give us that positive return in a different order than the stock market would. So bonds have historically been a good way to do this. Particularly government bonds have tended to go up when stock markets have gone down, but other bonds as well. There are other asset classes out there that investors can explore, but typically stocks and bonds are the most readily accessible to people.
And what would be another asset class? Would real estate be considered one?
Real estate could certainly be considered one. Some of the other investments that take very long time horizons along the same line, there are people who are looking at farmland and timberland and those types of real assets. Commodities is an area that some investors have explored.
So since we are looking at real volatility coming our way, what asset classes are interesting you?
Well, what's interesting, for instance, in the market sell-off we've just been through, government bonds tended to move upwards. So there's not only did they not lose, but they did provide some counter force to it. So part of your question is, well, how much risk can I have, and can I have 100% in stocks, or can I have only 50%, and do I want to have something in government bonds? Now the bond area is so interesting too. Because if interest rates go up, then bond prices tend to go down. So there's a new kind of a fund or investment out there called an unconstrained, where the bond manager has a lot more flexibility, and they are worrying about how do I protect the portfolio value if interest rates go up. So we're using some of these. And we're also using some just straight government bonds, and they're going to react differently. Hopefully they'll react differently.
As a hedge against the volatility. We're going to take a short break and then talk about this idea of saving and more about what a long-term investor is supposed to do right now. We'll be right back. Faith Middleton, thank you so much for listening. Thanks again to Lori Mack, who has been sitting in this chair for the times when I'm on assignment and has done a terrific job. She's the senior producer of the show. Jonathan McNichol is our producer, and I'm with Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven, and we are responding to The noise out there in terms of the economy, the wild ride that the stock markets, there are many of them around the world, have been taking us on, and how to think about all this from two people who spend their lives doing just that. They've been on the show for many, many years. Okay, so what would be a typical percentage of stocks in a portfolio, right now?
Well, for someone who's willing to have medium risk, then probably 50 to 60% stocks. And this is, of course, going to vary. And the question is, what is medium risk?
Well, even if you're in retirement?
Well, I'm assuming that medium risk means that they can take medium risk. Now, someone in retirement, maybe that's too aggressive. Now, one of the significant things is what we've been saying is you've been saying, well, the market's going to go crazy. Should we sell? And our response is that we shouldn't be in and out, that these things we have a strategy, we need to be moving them forward and not jumping in and out and holding to those strategies.
Yes, although isn't that a tricky thing? Because I've met people who've said, you know, I bought these stocks decades ago and you can just stick them in the kitchen drawer, close it and forget about them, you know, because they just grow over time. And we have seen there are major drops in some blue chip stocks. And so it almost seems to me that all the rules that people come up with are topsy-turvy in this past decade. Is that accurate?
I think they're topsy-turvy all the time. And so, you need a strategy that's going to work your way through these things and recognize that there's nothing perfect. And you're asking, well, sort of, what should I have? And I'm saying, well, a medium risk person, maybe 50 or 60% stocks. And that's clearly not 80% stocks.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, the question, well, how do I decide which stocks we're going to have and these kinds of things? And where should the rest of the money go?
And we see what happens when things are really booming. Everybody wants to pile in. And they're reaching things when the stocks really are now are at the top of the market. And so you've missed a lot of the gain. And when things are terrible, people are racing away from the market. And then when things turn around, they're not there for that either.
And Faith, I mean, I think you are just absolutely spot on. And one of the challenges when we think about risk, well, where was the risk in that cycle? The risk wasn't when the market was at its bottom and everyone felt terrible at stocks and just wanted to get out of them. The risk was at the top when everyone loved stocks and said, this is the best thing ever. We should be putting every bit of our money into stocks. So, you know, we're now looking at, so where are we today? And, you know, I talk to people and I don't hear anyone saying that they absolutely love stocks, nor do I hear the abject pessimism that, you know, we would see if we were looking at a market bottom. So it kind of puts us somewhere in the middle. I think this illustrates, again, the importance of having that long-term strategy. So let's use Bob's example of a person who has a 60% stock portfolio, which is sort of, this is your classic balanced portfolio allocation. And now we've gone through a period where markets around the world are off a little bit, and maybe our stock allocation has fallen from 60% to 55%, just because our bonds and cash held up value a little bit better during the market sell-off. Well, now, if I'm going to follow my disciplined strategy, I should be looking at now increasing my equity exposure. And if I'm uncomfortable, I can do it over time. I don't have to do it all at once. I can sort of take a nibble at it here and there. And the flip side of this is when the markets are booming and my stocks are doing well, and now my 60% target has drifted up and I'm at 65, even though I love stocks, even though they're giving me wonderful double-digit returns, I should be trimming those back. And this is the hard part about being a disciplined long-term investor. We can't fall in love with anything. We need to follow our plan.
Ah, interesting. Richard, Faith Middleton with Bob and Charlie Kreitler. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to be on here. The statement I'd like to make is, considering the whole subject matter of investment, if you're a young person listening to this show, you get the impression that a lot of the focus is stocks and, of course, diversification and other things. But probably the most important thing a young person listening to this show should be told is that the best investment they can make at this time in their life is in their education and keeping an eye on the world where you're looking for opportunities once that education avails you of some money. The only thing I'd like to really add to this whole conversation is I think young people need to hear that education is their best investment at this time. As you get older, maybe then you can talk about the stock market and other things.
Oh, Richard, I appreciate the spirit of what you're saying. It's an interesting point because when we talk about diversification through the years on this show, we talk about it not just in terms of one's portfolio, but across a life. And I've learned that from the Kreitler philosophy here. And I think it's a fascinating idea that it involves your home, you know, where you live, how you live, what your insurance might be. And as you say, Richard, you know, in investment in education, of course, the questions start to come at, you know, what is the cost of that? What is a wise move in that respect? Maybe that's just a piece of a lifetime portfolio. I think that's part of what you're getting at.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, I think we would agree with Richard wholeheartedly on this one. I mean, there's no better thing that you can get for yourself than an excellent education. You know, when we are talking with younger people who maybe haven't gotten that great start yet, maybe they don't have a portfolio built up, you know, I think that some of the most important things that they need to be considering are, so what is the rate that I should be saving out of my income right now? And should that be going towards debt payment because my credit cards or my student loan debt may have very high interest rates? Or should that start going into, you know, some sort of a long-term savings plan? But usually we don't start thinking too hard about what is my asset allocation and so on until someone's got a portfolio saved that's sort of roughly two times what their annual income might be. And the sort of logic on that is, well, if I can aspirationally save 15% of my income and I think that I can get a roughly 7-8% out of a long-term portfolio, that's about the turning point where the portfolio can start to generate more than you're able to save.
So I don't want to go down this side road very far, but I was talking to a dean of a college, and he said to me, you know, I think between you and me, I would tell my child to go to a community college for 2 years at that cost, and then we would then and do well, and then we would transfer for the second 2 years to the college of his or her dreams, thereby cutting the amount of money you needed to spend by 50%, essentially, or more. And therefore, and you have a degree from the ideal place that you've wanted to go. And I thought that was so interesting. Of course, I'm trying to get at here how expensive it can be, the debt that can sit on your shoulders, taking out loan after loan and thinking, well, someday I'll pay this back. I know so many people who struggle, even the President of the United States and the First Lady struggle for decades under that debt. Okay, so let's get back to, we talked about 50-60% in stocks would be a typical classification. So if we're expecting lower returns and increased volatility, what about the gold position? Gold is still not doing well, correct?
Well, let Bob talk about gold because that's been my fort, and within the firm we go back and forth on it. But gold really has been a disappointment, and the overall logic on gold is that historically, when everything else collapses, gold does extraordinarily well, and that just has not been happening. So something, either the world has changed, or we haven't gotten desperate enough to do that. But there really is no indication that gold is moving to fulfill its historical role of protecting in really bad times. Now, as I say, maybe in the future that's going to happen, but for Bob, that's been a big surprise. And there are always surprises out there, but that's one of them.
In terms of unexpected good news, you were saying just before the show started, so I don't want to lose this opportunity, that there's talk that there are, among the nation's productivity numbers, when those come out and they're good, everybody is so happy because it's showing that we're getting a much more solid foundation for things. There's been talk that there are missing productivity numbers, and I mean that in a good way.
I think this is an absolutely fascinating question that people are asking right now, and I think it's a very fair point. And you know, at the heart of it is, are there some components of productivity that are not being measured or are being measured poorly? And an example in my own life, so I get in my car on my drive home, and before I start to put the car into gear, I pull out my cell phone and I look at the map that says where the traffic is. So over the course of a year, how many hours have I saved by not sitting in traffic? What did I do with that time? And there's absolutely no way that that savings or that benefit to me was measured. Another example that I've heard is, so now we've got, of course, this very disruptive technology from Uber, which allows ordinary people who own a car to do ride sharing and have riders who are going to pay for a ride. Now, on one part of the equation, we have what might have been a cab fare that was going to be paid, and that's going to disappear from the GDP number. That money is not being spent. And of course, remember that GDP is a spending number, not a wealth number.
So you're saying that the data hasn't caught up with the way we're living.
That's right. That's right. So how do, in this case, do we now measure the fact that that Uber driver picked up that revenue? Now, that's being picked up, but there's going to also be a savings to the person who took the ride. And that savings number doesn't get shown in any sort of GDP calculations.
So, or if anything, it's a negative number because it's cheaper.
That's right. That's right.
So we also, the other piece of good news for many people would be the fact that oil is cheaper. And you were saying, Charlie, that amounts to a kind of tax cut for companies and for individuals. So that's another piece of good news. This idea, I don't want the show to close without talking about saving. You're saying that when the market is roiling and when we look like we're going to have maybe some lower returns in the next year or two, if that's the case, it's more important than ever to save. Well, how much is enough to save? You know, what percentage are we talking about? Can you save a little bit and have it mean something?
Well, the answer is yes, and we both worked on the National Savings Guidelines quite a number of years ago, and sort of the benchmark number was save 15%. And for many people, that's a stretch, but if you save it first, if it comes out of your paycheck, or another option is that when you get a pay raise, you save the pay raise and you don't spend it. But in a period of lower returns, the savings become more important, not less important. So you need to push those numbers up, and you need to do it as young as possible.
Yeah, the age that one begins is extremely important. And if you start when you're in your 30s, boy, life's a whole lot easier than if you start when you're in your 50s and 60s.
Wow, I'm just telling you, if you're in your 30s and you're hearing my voice right now, I wish that at 30 I had done what my seatmate at the newspaper where I worked, you know, we were reporters together, and she did what you're talking about. And every, you know, 2 weeks when our paychecks came out, hers went into a small investment. And let me tell you, she retired long ago. So if you're 30, start doing this. How much time do we have? Are we out of time? Oh, it's too bad. There's so much more to talk about. Thank you both so much. Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, recipes, value wines, cocktails, everything right now at Fuchmoose.org and The Faith Middleton Show. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.